T-Boz's nickname if TLC had stuck with the iLocation naming theme for the whole group.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
Hello, everybody. It is episode 176 of Wreckatopia. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Jeremy Scott.
Justice for Blunted.
That's right. And also, welcome Aaron Dicer.
Hidally-ho, Apocarinos.
That's right. And today's big recommend is Apocalypto. We'd also like to welcome chat who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. We appreciate that. Let's get on to our small recommends. Aaron, what do you got?
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Our friend Jonathan recently released his favorite movies of all time, and so I added them to my watch list, and I watched one of them called Scarlet Street. Scarlet Street is, I think, a 1945 film. It stars Edward G. Robinson, Joan Bennett, Dan Duryea. And basically, this is a story of a man who is in a marriage he's not enjoying and who looks upon others who mess around in their marriages in some kind of positive light, like, oh, what if I could find a fling? And he finds this woman who seems to take an interest in him. On the side, he is also a painter. And I'm not going to give the whole plot away, but I think some of this can be helpful to drawing you in. He's a painter. And his wife says he's terrible, but he loves doing it, and he's passionate about it. But you get a sense through the movie that he is becoming obsessed with this younger woman, and she seems amenable to it, but we find out there's maybe more nefarious things at play. So the movie goes from there and is a really tight, interesting, clever thriller that I had never heard of and am glad I watched. It surprisingly feels very modern for a 1945 movie, in my opinion, in the way that it deals with these themes and what happens. It goes some places you aren't expecting, which I always think is fun, and ends in a really, let's just say, not the most silver linings, happy-go-lucky place. So this will be an interesting one to check out. It's called Scarlet Street. You can check it out. I think I watched it on HBO Max. It's also on Criterion, I believe. But it's out there.
I had not heard of this for some reason. It has a name that seems like something that I should have heard of, but I have not. I'm going to have to check it out myself. I read over Jonathan's list too. I probably kind of glossed over it as I was going over his list, but yeah, that sounds very interesting. I definitely want to see that. I watched a movie on one of the Criterion discs that I have. I'm sure you can find it on Criterion as well. It's called Matewan. It's a story of coal mining in West Virginia. Chris Cooper in his film debut, I believe, in this one. It is directed by John Sayles, who's known for 8 Men Out and Lone Star. It is about this coal mine in West Virginia where Chris Cooper is coming in as, I guess, under the cover of being just a regular guy looking for work out in this little town. What he's actually there for is to try to start a union. And back in the 1920s, I believe this is where this is set, trying to create a union with a company that basically owns an entire town that is almost a death warrant. You have to do it very carefully. And so he meets up with someone who's going to try to help him organize. A man played by Bob Gunton, who you know as the warden in Shawshank Redemption, is the guy that helps him. And then you have a contingent of black workers led by a guy named Fuclos. They call him Fuclos. James Earl Jones plays that character. Trying to form a union, you have to get everybody on board. You can't get, you know, just a few and call yourself a union. You have to like be able to get everybody. So that's one of the struggles of trying to form a union, is trying to get a bunch of white people to work with Italians and black people. That's like something that's really hard to get where like everybody's got the same pay and the same benefits and all this other type of stuff. That is something that is a big struggle. But meanwhile, you also have this company that owns this town, basically, that is definitely going to try everything that they can to make sure that they break up whatever union. They try to do a whole bunch of underhanded things to try to break up this union, and if that fails, then hey, maybe we'll bring out the guns, who knows. It's a very interesting look at labor practices in the U.S. And it actually is based on a true story. I think it's very close to the true story. It's not like 100% or anything, but it is one of those movies that's like, it's pretty close to what actually happened in this town back in the 20s. Chris Cooper, of course, is excellent in it. James Earl Jones, always a welcome sight. David Strathairn shows up as the town sheriff in this one. A lot of actors who were like, oh yeah, wow, I didn't know they did stuff before this movie that I first saw them in or whatever. Hmm. Like Mary McDonnell is in this one as well. This is a really good movie. I've had it in my collection for a while. And it's just, the name of it has always sort of like, kept me away from it, because it doesn't tell you what this movie is really about, I sat there and I was going through the collection, I was looking at this, and I looked at the back of the thing, I was like, oh, this sounds really good. So I watched it that day, and so very, very good movie. If you have not heard of this, seek it out. I believe you will like it.
Wow, you guys both chose two highly respected, obscure, older titles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm recommending Superman, the
new
one.
Yeah, yeah.
Not quite as obscure or old. You know, back in the early aughts, Ang Lee made Hulk, and he tried to emulate a comic book by doing panels of the... I don't know how much you guys remember the movie Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
I've probably watched it more than most of you. And I found it really interesting, but ultimately distracting. And I think most people found it distracting. This Superman from James Gunn is the most feeling like I'm inside of a comic book superhero movie I've ever seen. And I think what has put some people off of it is part of what I love about it, and it's all the wild, insane stuff, like anti-proton rivers and rifts in the dimensions and kaiju, and that stuff is all over the comics, not just Superman even, but particularly Superman. That stuff is really common, and all the films prior to this have stripped that kind of stuff away, and I think in the process have made them feel more like movies rather than comic book movies, or I'm inside a comic book movie. I don't know what to tell you other than this movie reached out and grabbed me with a hug, and I have been thinking about it ever since. David Cornsweet is probably the most relatable Superman I've ever seen. And the movie twists a single tiny piece of Superman lore in a way that I think makes Superman more interesting than ever. And if you haven't seen it, I'm not going to spoil it. But yeah, I might have been in the bag already just because I knew he had posted about All-Star Superman, which is a graphic novel that I have, where he fights kaiju and goes to the sun and all kinds of weird shit. I also like Nicholas Holt. I thought he was pure evil in a way that we haven't really seen from Lex Luthor before. And the dynamic between the two of them, more personal than it's been in the movies before. There you go. Jeremy loved Superman. I already watched most of it again a second time last night.
I think Aaron and I might be the only people in the world that don't like this movie.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say I didn't like it. I wouldn't say that. I don't think I was over the moon about it like I have seen a lot of people. There was a lot of nonsense in this that was just like any other comic book movie, and I couldn't get past it. But still, that nonsense that people that I talk about are things that people really, truly, genuinely enjoy in it. And so, who am I to say that you can't enjoy that or whatever? So, I wish I could be like you guys or like Jeremy and love this movie. But so far I have not gotten to that point. Although this has got to be the fastest I've ever seen a big, huge blockbuster make it to. It's not on HBO Max, is it? Did you buy this?
Or? I paid $25 on Amazon Prime.
It's still a short window for a movie like this.
One of the shortest I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And his reason for it doesn't make any sense, honestly, because he said Peacemaker ended up coming out season two earlier than he had planned, and he wanted people to be able to enjoy Superman before they go into Peacemaker 2, which I don't understand how he has the power to push Superman to digital but not hold Peacemaker off for a month.
Right?
That doesn't make sense to me.
There's so much about streaming that we don't understand. It's almost scary.
Yeah.
It's almost scary. There was an article about Highest to Lowest and how it, you know, the new Spike Lee movie, how it's getting its cursory in theaters run so that it can get Oscar consideration, but it's going to be on streaming as soon as you know it. And I'm like, is this not a movie that you could have made $50-60 million on at least and then did that same exact thing?
Spike Lee.
Yeah, what's the harm in that? Like, there seems to be, they seem to think that it's like there's something about being in the theatrical window that hurts them, and I don't know what it is. So yeah. Like, you know, it's really getting silly out there, man.
It's
getting silly.
Chris and I had similar feelings on this. Again, didn't hate it at all. In fact, there's a movie in here that I love as much as you do, Jeremy. All the Superman stuff worked like gangbusters for me. Rachel Brosnahan as Lois Lane is inspired. I think she's a great choice. I think Nicholas Holt's the best thing about the movie, in my opinion. You're right. There's a sniveling venom to his version of this character that is really compelling, and I like the way it handles that relationship. But the stuff around it just seemed to be a little willy-nilly silly for my taste and tonally disparate enough that I felt shook back and forth. I also think it's a movie that's to be about something, but never really takes the time to actually be about something. It just kind of waves at a lot of modern issues and says, see, this is an issue, without ever really taking a true point of view on it, if that makes sense, at least as I watched it. But man, there are times during this movie where I'm like, yes, this is the Superman movie I want to see. So I totally get the emotion behind it, because man, when it's cooking for me, it was cooking. I really liked it.
All right, let's get on to our big recommend, and it was Aaron's choice. So Aaron, take it away.
I'm fine, it's just that you're so
big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Apocalypto is a 2006 action thriller made by hundreds of extremely talented craftspeople and performers and directed by nobody. On to the synopsis. The movie opens with a quote about how societies are destroyed from within, a sadly outdated and no longer relevant sentiment. Then it's on to a good old-fashioned pig hunt. Groups of tribesmen in the Yucatan are herding a pig towards Chekhov's Home Alone-style forest traps and having a great success. The kill gives way to a process of organ donation to those who need them, or those you want to make fun of by making them eat pig balls. It becomes clear every culture has its trolley youth. But afterwards, a more mature elder, Flint Sky, who we later find is the father of one of the youths, tries to help out with a leaf-based topical fertility solution. As the crew continues to cut up together, literally and figuratively, a rustling alerts them to another tribe in the woods. Things get tense as the strangers reveal themselves and want to offer some fish for safe passage through. They are apparently refugees looking for a new start, but with fear in their eyes. After returning back to the village, the father and son have a conversation about how fear can be an infectious disease. And an older woman presses Blunted, the pig ball eater from before, to please go sex up her daughter because she wants those grandchildren. Meanwhile, at Jaguar Paw's place, this is the son of the father-son duo, we see him, his pregnant wife Seven, and his young son Turtles Run enjoying some playtime before returning to find out that maybe the more mature father elder is not all that mature after all, as his leaf suggestion is now Burning Blunted Nethers. FYI, Burning Blunted Nethers was the name of my high school ska band.
Nice.
Around the community fires later that night, the tribe hears a story of man's inability to feed their holes, and Jaguar Paw's unborn child dances to the drums in the womb of his mother. The next morning, JP awakes from a nightmare inspired by the fear he saw in the traveling tribe, and that fear might be confirmed as a new group of hunters now stealthily appear on the outskirts of the camp with fire and arrows. The invaders attack and burn the entire camp to the ground while killing and kidnapping the previously peaceful village. Jaguar Paw, alerted by a dog's sudden silence, manages to get his family out and starts to lower them into a cave well for safety. He's spotted by an invader who tries to lower them faster as the attacker runs towards him, but eventually has to drop them to handle his business. The family survives the fall, and JP promises them he will be back for them, but he has to go help first. He rushes back into the fray and gets the upper hand on one particularly nasty invader named Middle Eye, but at the last second, the boss invader, Zero Wolf, stops him. Later, when the man he almost killed overhears him apologize to his father, he decides to slit Flint Sky's throat right in front of Jaguar Paw as punishment for almost killing him. He then gives him the nickname Almost before knocking him out with a club. The next day, as the invaders are packing up to leave with their prisoners, one of them catches Jaguar Paw glancing in the direction of the well and decides to check it out. He suspects something is up, but decides to just cut the rope leading into it and let it be. As they lead the adults out of the ashes of the camp, the children are left to fend for themselves, and we pan down to see Seven and Turtles Run still stuck in the well. During the transport, we see Zero Wolf do some Rocky-style eye surgery on his son Cut Rock. Middle Eye tortures the sick and dying prisoners with glee, and the kids can't follow the adults through a river crossing as a young girl promises to do her best to take care of the little ones. Back at the well, Seven stitches up Turtles Run's leg with decapitated bug bites, as one does. As the prisoner caravan hits a cliff road, Middle Eye decides to toss some dead weight over the edge, which leads to Zero Wolf, who I'm just now thinking might be the calorie-free version of Classic Wolf, putting Middle Eye in his place by offering a challenge that is not accepted. The journey continues as a giant tree falls in the middle of the road, causing Zero Wolf to say, "I'm walking here," like he's a Dustin Hoffman stand
that
or something.
That is the weirdest part of this whole fucking movie.
It was so a Midnight Cowboy reference, was it not?
Even though he never once stops to chat about how underrated Hoffman's Hook performance actually was. A bit down the road, a young diseased girl prophesies that day will turn to night, and it's the jaguar to beware of, because apparently the disease she's suffering from is precogitis. Once they finally get back to the city, we see the scope of the Mayan capital, a living organism of all different kinds of commerce, chaos, and economical disparity. The women are led off to be auctioned, and the men are painted blue and led through a hallway of wall art depicting how they might die as if they are in the second most depressing attraction queue experience ever, next to the Expedition Everest ride at Animal Kingdom. As the men finish their ascent to the top of the temple, we realize they're here as human sacrifices to the god of the city. We see a couple of people gruesomely sacrificed, just in case you forgot that Mel Gibson was directing, before it's now Jaguar Paw's turn. But in about as pure a deus ex machina as deus ever machina'd, the girl's prophecy comes true as a total solar eclipse happens right before the knife comes down. And it happens at like 10 times the speed until it lingers at the full eclipse for a while and then speeds back up as it exits.
I'm so glad you said this.
Me too. I got like 5 notes about it.
The Mayans take this to mean it's time to take a break from their public game of cranial stair bowling and send Jaguar Paw and his remaining Blue Man group off to be disposed of in a different way. Target practice. Blunted is one of the first to do the Rickon Stark memorial run to safety, as he and another tribal friend are shot at with arrows, spears, and slingshots. If they somehow survive this, Cut Rock has been stationed at the end to finish the job Midsommar style. Next up, Jaguar Paw does what we've all been waiting for someone to do throughout the history of pop culture. He freaking runs zigzags. But even that can't keep Zero Wolf from loosing an arrow on target. But just as Cut Rock, who I'm just now thinking could be the stage name of a much buffer Chris Rock, looks to finish him off, the somehow still alive Blunted distracts him long enough for Jaguar to break off the arrowhead sticking out of his body and stab him with it as Wolf looks on. And now the father whose son was killed by the son who saw his father slaughtered sprints after him to try to keep him from getting away. But Jaguar Paw, who I'm just now thinking could have started a group of tribal warriors called the Paw Patrol, is too fast and too clever and finds his way back to heal in the jungle he knows so well. As he finds a tree to hide in, we see his blood drip on a passing hunter and then also find out he has ended up between a Black Panther, no, not that Black Panther, and her cub. He's now in a full sprint to escape this beast, but just in the nick of time, the panther is cut off by one of the baddies, who he quickly makes a meal of in what may be the grossest moment in the movie, which is saying a lot for after what we've been through for the last 90 minutes already. The Mayan hunters are freaked out by the omen of the jaguar, but Zero Wolf tells them to get over it, and the pursuit continues. Back at the cave well, Seven is fending off her own predator and doing a mighty fine job of taking care of her and her family as they wait. As we get back to the Mayan pursuit, a snake takes out another of Zero's crew as Jaguar Paw's Deus continues to machina the heck out of this movie. The hunters are right on top of Jaguar now, but then this guy just does a Peter Pan right off this waterfall right here. He somehow survives and gives a speech taunting them. Zero Wolf says they're going over the falls after him and kills his man that suggests they climb down instead. Another man dies on the jump down, and then there were 5 hunters left. But Jaguar Paw knows it's his jungle now, and he knows where John Rambo hid all the traps, so we all have an inkling of how this is going to end. After a quicksand baptism, he is cleansed of his fear, and one hornet's nest, one poisonous toad, 3 blow darts, and 1 slide move later, fly, which I'm just now thinking would have probably been T-Boz's nickname if TLC had stuck with the eye location naming theme for the whole group. Right on cue, the rain starts to pour down, and now the third act finally has its ticking clock as the well where Seven and Turtles Run are in is beginning to fill. Jaguar Paw leads Zero to a standoff, and when an arrow doesn't finish the job on Jaguar, Zero darts toward him, only to be impaled by the hidden pig spike machine from before. Seven gives underwater birth to their child as Jaguar just has the final 2 henchies to deal with. They all run to the ocean only to see the arrival of some Spanish conquistadors. This is enough to distract the final 2 pursuers, and Jaguar Paw finds his way back to his nearly submerged family to help them escape. In a final act of wisdom, Jaguar Paw leads his family away from the approaching Spaniards to a new life in the jungle, where his father hunted, and he hunted, and Paw's son will hunt, and maybe even Turtles Run's son will hunt as well, which of course will mean the jungle will have been hunted by all the generations, from Paw's paw to the kid who calls Paw, 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 Paw. And that is Apocalypto.
Mm.
What did you guys think this time through?
Put in overtime on
Listen,
that one,
I just,
didn't you?
I just do what happens. I don't know.
I think that if we can get beyond the historical accuracy of this movie and just forget completely that there's any kind of, you know, stuff that you can go check. This movie is very well made and is a great action movie. I don't think that it needed to be so damn gross. There are so many things that Mel Gibson infuses into his movies where it's clear that right off the bat, this movie is like, how manly are you? Let's see how manly you are, because we're talking about hunters. We're talking about a guy. Can you father children? I don't know if you can father children or not. Are you a real man? I don't know if you are. Eat this pig's balls, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's just, it's like a constant thing. And then the father comes to the son and is like, I never taught you. I taught you to not have fear in this world. Like, that's something that you can really teach, you know, like it's one of these type of things that, like, everything is like very manly, manly, manly. And it's like, okay, Mel Gibson putting his mark on this. And again, what is his deal with torture? He loves torture in almost everything that he does. That was a thing that in Lethal Weapon, where it was like a big thing where he's just getting tortured and never talking and blah, blah, blah. And I know that's not his movie that he directed and everything, but that seems like something like, I really like that. Let's do Braveheart that way. Let's do Apocalypto this way. So yeah, there's a lot of things about this. It's like, this is a manly man picture. This is, you know, you, but anyway, I can get beyond that. The movie is very well made. I love how it starts off as this sort of like, this is a drama of you know, a tribe and what they're trying to accomplish and how they live together and everything. And then just when you think that you're at your happiest or when you're at your most comfortable, something happens to upset that. And I cannot get Blunted's face out of my head when they are all tied up together and he's like, our lives are over.
Yep.
Our lives are over. I can't get that out of my head. It's one of the most striking moments of the film, I believe, just watching that and thinking and putting yourself in that person's shoes. What would you would sit there and think the same exact thing. And there's a moment of just pure despair that I can't shake. The next 45 minutes are a little too slow for me, considering what happens. They are walked to the, you know, to this city and like, it's just a slow, you know, here's how things are, where it's a weird Mad Max territory that they're running into here, where just everything is just awful and all the citizens seem to be on board with how awful it is because they believe this sacrifice is going to help them with their crops and everything. But it just seems like it takes entirely too long to walk them all the way out here and then up to this temple where they're going to have their heads lopped off and all that stuff and whatever. But once they are sort of allowed to run and they're avoiding all the arrows and stuff like that, this movie just takes off. It's just absolutely brilliant after this point. I don't understand. Maybe I'm talking completely out of my ass here, but I think even really good archers would have a hard time hitting these people with the accuracy that they do. Like, like they're moving and they're, and like that first, yeah, they're doing the Prometheus thing. They're running into the Rickard Stark thing, like you said. They're doing that thing where it's just like, come on, you know, do the serpentine thing, which is exactly what they do on the second run. And it's, they're doing that back and forth. And this guy just, the way it's edited, I don't like it at all. It's just like the guy that shows him, he kind of like does this whole, like, almost, yeah, I almost expected him to stick his finger in his mouth something like, and like, you know, check the wind or something like that. And he just shoots it up in the air. And it's like, they're still sitting there doing this. What did you time and like exactly get their geometric, you know, position to shoot that arrow perfectly at them? But anyway, once it gets to that point when it's him running basically back to his home turf, you're on my turf now. You don't know what's here. I'm going to run you through this place. I love it. There's a way too much Ex Machina stuff in this for sure, especially when he's getting chased by the Jaguar and like just so happens to coincide with them chasing him and they attack him and everything. But, and then, you know, I know, the one thing that I read about this, there's criticism about this movie being racist. And one of the things that, you know, that confuses the Mayans for the Aztecs. The Aztecs kind of did the stuff that they're depicting here. The Mayans didn't. There is one thing I chewed on it. I'm not in any position to say one way or the other. There was one criticism that says the conquistadors at the end are here to save this. Like, that's a criticism. Someone is that these are of savage people that they're fighting amongst each other, and the conquistadors have come in and they're their saviors. And I was like, well, I can see it that way, but at the same time, what we see Jaguar Paul's reaction to this at the end is, these are people to avoid. These are not people who are here to save anybody or save somebody from themselves. They're all about themselves is what they are. And that's what I took that to mean at the end. Now, I know that you can have any number of interpretations especially when you know history and things like that. But that was something I chewed over. I wanted to mention it because it is something that's out there, but I'm not sure I'm entirely on board with that criticism at all. Again, I don't have a historian's, you know, knowledge of what's going on or whatever, but it is easy to say that when you know the guy behind the camera and you want to say some things, you know, about him and everything. I don't think that's what's being said here, but anyway, enjoyed this movie immensely, despite the grossness that I think he could have cut out, but you know, or made a little bit, maybe he couldn't have, maybe it had to be this vicious. It's, you know, I don't know, but in the end, I like
it. Does. I think it's absolutely a Mel Gibson thing, and it's one thing that will probably keep me from loving any of his movies. Even the movie he made about a pacifist is really violent, brutal, and gross.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. And I'm not talking about Jesus. I'm talking about Andrew Garfield.
I was going to say that you mean the two movies he made about a pacifist.
So I understand that the conquistadors don't have any business being here at this time in the world. I get it. From a movie perspective, I find that reveal amazing because he is still trying to escape death. Mm-hmm. And he runs out onto the beach and there's more death. And it's a bigger death. And it's a scarier death. And I think from a storytelling standpoint, it's really, really powerful. Again, if historical inaccuracy is going to pull you out of it, I absolutely get it. But I love that reveal. I'm kind of with Chris on the pacing. I think the opening up until the battle at the village, or including the battle at the village, and then the ending, are all frenetic. I'm anxious. I'm on the edge of my seat. I'm really into all of it. And the middle is just kind of a lot of walking and that guy being really mean to Jaguar Paul. I was a little... The cutting back to the wife and the kid in the well, there are times it makes sense to me, right? Because he got injured when dude threw a rock down. And I love the insect pinchers as stitches. I think that's brilliant. I don't even know if that's real. But there's one scene where it cuts back and she's like singing him to sleep. And I'm like, are we just padding the runtime? Like, it might even be more interesting to see what her husband is envisioning might be happening to her rather than, well, she's singing him to sleep. I also wrote, I wrote this stream of consciousness as the movie is going. I don't understand the panic once it starts raining. His wife and kid can just float up to the top. And then she goes into labor or something. God damn it, she didn't look that pregnant. I really hate what the movie does to Blunted. I'm not sure who hurt Mel Gibson in his life that he decided to create a character that everyone was just going to shit on left and right. And only his wife treats him with any amount of kindness. And it just sucks. He's the most tragic character in the whole thing for me because it just goes from bad to worse to death for him. One praise I want to give the movie. I started watching this on Roku, and I got about a minute and a half in and realized, oh, there's not subtitles on yet. Surely this movie has subtitles. And I click, and they only have Spanish available. So I went over to Tubi, and they had English subtitles. But I think you could watch this movie with no subtitles and still understand about 95% of what's happening. And that is good filmmaking. And despite what I think of him as a human being, I don't think there's any doubt that Mel Gibson is a good filmmaker. But I almost turned him off. I was like, I want to see if I can figure this out. But I didn't want to come into this and be like, oh, that's why he did that. But I think the movie gives you enough context and facial expressions to know exactly what's happening. I can't imagine how miserable it must have been to make this movie. I mean, I know that they had tons of rains that caused delays, but somebody in the chat said shooting that river crossing must have been hell. And I'm like, yeah, the whole thing must have been hell. Being in a jungle for months on end filming. Because, you know, there are snakes and things, poisonous things. You know, they don't clear out when Hollywood comes in to make a movie about the Mayans.
They don't? Oh, that's weird.
I love what you said about him screaming our lives are over. I thought that was a really powerful moment. The most powerful moment for me was when they had to watch the women be sold into slavery from like 50 feet away. That was crushing. I have several notes on the eclipse. Go ahead.
Including one, you know, it was his mother-in-law who nobody wanted. They took her. And you would think they'd know the market and they wouldn't take someone like that, but they did. And then now she's here, and now where does she go once they just let her go or whatever? What does she do now?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not gonna go too hard on the eclipse. You guys have already covered that. That's not how it works.
I was just like, man, that's coming in fast. It's not gonna be there very long. And then it just stays.
Well, you could lop off so many heads.
It'd be one thing if it was like an effect where, you know, this was happening over a long period of time, and so you kind of speed up as it gets there, but it literally is showing the time that it's important for the eclipse to happen in real time. So it looks like there's no other interpretation except for that, you know, the Earth's rotation around the sun has sped up for a little bit and then slowed down and then sped up again. So
It's very ex machina-y. I see all the quality here. I enjoyed watching it. I don't think it needs to be that brutal. I don't think it needs to be that long. And the Mel Gibson-ness of it will probably keep me from, like, buying this and putting it on my shelf. But I'm glad I watched it, and it's really good.
Yeah, I think I like it more than you guys as a movie. I think everything you've said is correct and understandable, and I actually buy into, especially the slower middle act. That's actually a revelation with you guys talking about that. I'm glad you brought that up, because it's not something I experience, and I don't know if it's just because I'm so attached to Jaguar Paw and Blunted that I want to see how this trip goes for them, that I want to, you know, that I'm keen on, you know, Zero Wolf's challenge with Middle Eye, I thought was really important and interesting. But here's the thing. You can have the Zero Wolf Middle Eye challenge. You can have the prophetic girl. You can have these moments that add something to the movie quicker. Like, you can get through those in a more efficient way, I think. And I think that's a really valid criticism of the movie that I hadn't really thought of.
I mean,
way.
They could have simply montaged that a little bit, you know, and just, you know, Lord of the Rings'd it a bit and then got to these moments that he wants to get to. And I think it would have been fine.
Right. Yeah. It feels like a section that just was falling in love with what you, the work you've done. So you have to leave it in. You know, oh, this work we did at the river with the kids coming up and saying, I'll take care of them. It's so important. Like, you know, we worked hard to film that. And like, and so, you know, I think as a filmmaker, sometimes it's hard. They say, kill your babies. Sometimes it's hard to kill your babies. And I think you can feel that in that section. So, so I thought that was good. I think the cutting to the wife that you mentioned, Jeremy, is probably to avoid the criticism of just a woman in peril. That's her entire role, trying to give her agency in the escape. We even see her, you know, fashion a rope anchor and try to climb out. And so I think that's probably what that's about. That doesn't mean it works. That's what the attempt was.
It would have been awesome if she had been able to get it going, because I understand with the visual that he wants. He wants that birth to happen underwater. It doesn't happen without it. But I think I prefer it, just her being able to get to climb up that thing and you know, and survive on her own. But, you know, whatever. I guess you gotta take out one good thing to get another. So,
yeah. But you're right. The first and third acts, especially, are just fire. The first act is so efficient with its character exposition. We learn so much about these characters just by how they pal around and what they do, and we learn about this tribe and who they are and you know, how things work there. And it's just, it's so efficient and quick. And the opening attack is brutal and devastating and exciting. And the end is just a series of incredible moments. I think I call it the dodgeball run for the acts when they're coming at each other. It just reminds me of dodgeball in gym class, where everybody has to run for the ball at the same time. But that run for the acts is shot so well and so perfectly tensioned. And that slide is just perfect action filmmaking. When he gets hit, it's like he doesn't completely miss the blow, but gets under it enough to not, you know, be killed by it, and then grabs the axe and comes back. I just love that moment.
What else is kind of good about, like, the sort of how everything happens is that the main baddie, he is the last one that gets killed, but it's not some mega battle at the end. It's completely different, where he dies and there's still two other people left after that, which, you know, of course it gets blunted by the fact that they see the conquistadors later on. But, like, I like the fact that it didn't turn into this big, you know, type of thing.
Cocking their biceps. Impossible.
And the other moment that I always go back to is the story at the campfire. I just think it's really powerful. It sums up the themes of the movie so well. And it's just a really beautiful moment of community coming together to listen to somebody wise talk about what it means to be human and what the dangers are of being human. And that's why I think both of you have touched on it. I don't necessarily understand the conquistador accusation, because that doesn't fit the themes of the movie at all. If they're the saviors, and they are another, you know, men trying to fill their empty holes.
And that is something they've already sort of referenced, that these men are going to continue to look for things to make them happy over and over and over again, and nothing is ever going to sate it and everything. I hope I'm not misrepresenting that. That is on the Wikipedia page that I was reading on it. It's probably way more complex than I was giving it, but I read over that and I was like, at first I just kind of chewed over it and I said, I kind of get that. And then I sort of thought about it some more and I'm like, but you wouldn't have a character look at those people and go, I don't want to have anything to do with these people. And that's your main character of the movie. So, you know, there's probably a lot to deep dive on the historical inaccuracy.
Oh, for
and,
sure.
And how that misrepresents the people and how that is racist. But I think, again, I have trouble with that whole thing when we're talking about movies. And it's the same thing, we're talking about the Untouchables, and we're talking about these movies that where they're taking real people and then they change the story so much that it's like, well, that's not what that person was about, then whatever. So it's that same kind of deal. I do understand the creative license, but when you take creative license, you also weirdly misrepresent misrepresentation that, is that bad? It might be bad.
Yeah, I've heard the real jaguar paw was really problematic.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was
we've all seen the documents. Yeah, I mean, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I will finish by saying I think the reason I still do really have a fond place in my heart, despite all the reasons I would want to dismiss this movie, from the director to, you know, some of the choices we've talked about, those kind of things, is I really connect to what this movie is saying about the idea of trying to abandon human instinct towards violence. And when Jaguar Paul makes that decision at the end, he's making a peaceful decision, not a violent decision. And I also, this movie holds a mirror up to me in many ways and says, what would you do in this situation, Mr. Pacifist? How would you survive this? The answer is, I wouldn't. I have the privilege of the time that I live in and the place that I live in, and I have the privilege of my own upbringing and existence not to have to deal with those things. And so there is a really interesting cognitive conundrum for me to go, if I was born in the jungles where it was kill or be killed, what kind of person would I be? You know, where would my beliefs be about violence and pacifism? And I think this movie explores that really interestingly through Jaguar Paw, who is raised in a what appears to be a peaceful village, but then has to confront the horrors of conquest and violence. So, I think the movie means a lot to me for those reasons.
All right, let's get on to our super secret double feature.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
All right. I'm gonna go a little left of field, but there's a tie to both of these movies, I think, that I thought was pretty good. So, I am going to double feature this movie with the original Wicker Man. The story of the Wicker Man is, I don't want to really ruin a lot of things if you've never seen it. So, yes, there was a remake the very year this Apocalypto movie came out. There was a remake with Nicolas Cage that is probably more famous to most of you at this point because of the Nicolas Cage antics that are going on. But please watch the original. The original is so, so good. But the fact is that is a people that the cop goes to this island and they are having trouble growing crops. And that is I think most people kind of know where the Wicker Man goes. So I don't want to completely spoil it. But I think that the connections are there. Now, action adventures, there's probably a million that I could have come up with as far as action adventure type of movies where, you know, there's not really much action adventure going on in The Wicker Man. It's more of a mystery than anything. But I thought there's some pretty good ties between those two movies.
Interesting. Nice. Interesting. I'm going with Furiosa, a Mad Max saga story, whatever that title is. I just saw a lot of parallels in somebody being taken from a peaceful settlement and then having to confront a new environment that's full of weird things you don't understand and violent people who want to do whatever they want to you. Clearly, the plots aren't the same, but tonally and thematically, I think there are enough similarities there. I almost went with Prey, but I thought that was too on the nose, and you know how I hate to go on the nose. So I ended up going with Furious.
Yeah, that's a good choice. The movie that came to my mind is a movie I just saw for the first time recently. It's The Mission, right?
Oh, De Niro, yeah. I think. Yeah.
I just seen that recently, so it was in my brain, and I was just like, oh, this kind of feels like The Mission. The Mission is, in many ways, the bad example of, you know, the white saviorism of these movies usually, and this, you know, doesn't have that unless you count The Conquistadors, but yeah, that was the one that popped in my brain.
Nice.
So you were probably pretty frightened there, Jeremy, when I compared this movie to Mad Max very briefly.
I actually said, don't smile.
Nice.
I did smile internally because it felt like, okay, at least he saw a little bit of what I was seeing here. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Let's go on to the homework for next week. It's my turn, and I am going to pick a movie that I know for sure Jeremy puts in high regard, and I'm not sure about Aaron at all on this movie, but this is next week's homework is going to be Broadcast News from 1987. James L. Brooks movie starring William Hurt, Albert Brooks, and Holly Hunter. This movie was a Best Picture nominee back in 1987. Couldn't beat The Last Emperor, though. Couldn't beat the 1987's Best Picture nominees, by the way, some of the worst I've ever seen.
I didn't like The Last Emperor.
Yeah, Fatal Attraction got in there.
Oh, wow.
There was some other one. And I was watching Matewan, which got nominated for our cinematography, and it came out in 1987. And I was like, Matewan's better than at least three of these movies, you know, that got nominated. I guess it just didn't make enough box office for people to really like it. But anyway, Broadcast News, I know is a favorite of Jeremy's, is one of my favorites. Aaron, what do you think about this movie?
I saw it for the first time within the last couple of years, and it is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I loved it, and there are many reasons why, and we shall go into them all.
This movie is probably in my top 20. I've seen it so many times, I quit counting, and what I love most about it is that the things it is trying to say about integrity, about news, journalism, and even romance, all still play perfectly. None of that is dated. Just the only thing that's dated is the cars and the clothes. But what it's trying to say plays in this culture landscape today as good as it ever did.
Yeah, it is. And it's they're talking about infotainment even back in the late 80s and God, even in the 70s with network, this has always been a problem. It's just that it never became such a pervasive. I don't think it became so pervasive until after the cable news wars or whatever started happening. And God, we have so much of this now. It's so insane. So, looking forward to, diving into that one next week. Looks like we have some time for some questions. Let's look at the list here.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Oh, this is a good one. What do you think is your single greatest contribution to CinemaSins? What do you think is your single greatest contribution to the world? What do you got, guys?
To the world?
Mm-hmm.
Goodness gracious. Just,
this is how I have benefited the world.
I mean, that's hard. I mean, I just read this question as, what do you think? Well, the Prometheus School of Running Away from Things is one of the few jokes that we make that I have seen out in the wild being used by people that aren't us. And that was a phrase that I don't believe had ever been uttered until we uttered it. And it, it wasn't even in our Prometheus video. It was in a later video. And so I, whenever I see that, I take great pride because I think it's really hard to come up with anything that any part of the culture adopts. As far as my greatest contribution to the world, I'm just going to say being a good husband to my wife is probably the best thing I've done in the world. So.
I will remind you, Jeremy, that you did answer this question in the email. So, you know, you did answer the question as you wrote it, but there was one other thing, and I will get to that one other thing in a minute. But yeah, mine is probably the Apple Sin. Nearly, from the very beginning, anyone eating an apple in a movie has been, you know, has been marked as an asshole, and we've done plenty of things. That's that sin has evolved into a whole bunch of other different things over the years and everything. But I believe Star Trek, the Captain Kirk scene, where he's doing that, that simulation, that's where the first one was. And I believe it just, it's amazing how many times you see that in movies where somebody is just being nonchalant or being kind of like aloof or whatever. They're like, they must have a bushel of apples somewhere on the side to get from craft services or something. And they're like, here, have this. You need to be aloof. You need to be an asshole, you know, or whatever. And they're like, okay. And they just, you know, and so, so that's my, probably my biggest contribution, to the world. And this is really honestly the, something that both Jeremy and I, are a part of is contributing to our local Tennessee Performing Arts Center. We met up with the people who run that run sort of the, I don't know what you would say, they don't run TPAC, but they run like the marketing of it and the and everything. And so We have contributed to them over the last 5 or 6 years, maybe longer, and everything. And they are, you know, they're so happy with us and everything. And I love seeing the smiles that it puts on their faces every time we meet with them like once a year or so and catch up. So that's probably the biggest thing to the world. Maybe there might be more to that actually, but that's one of the biggest things.
Yeah, and I'm incredibly proud of that. We get invited to a luncheon every year. Everybody who donates to TPAC does. And I'm not always able to go, but when we go, the TPAC has programs in Nashville, in elementary and middle schools, to get kids into the arts, and into theater. And those select kids from that program will come perform. Like last time I went, they did, the opening song from the Lion King musical. And it was incredible. And you can just see how good theater inspires people to make art, even if it's not theater. You can trace from Rent straight to Lin-Manuel Miranda, you know, straight to everybody who saw Hamilton from the age 10 to 20 and is now wanting to be in theater or a songwriter, what have you. So the fact that we've been able to contribute in a small way financially to that kind of growth and development in our city means a lot to me. So yeah, thanks for reminding
absolutely.
Me absolutely.
Yep.
My greatest contribution to CinemaSins was probably that TLC joke in the synopsis today.
Yep.
That
correct.
Was probably the best thing I've ever done.
Yep.
No, I put a few things down, but I think I'm going to land on naming the Sin Counter Cinny. That happened during a first South Park video on TV Sins, and we did a "They Killed Cinny" joke, and so it became Cinny, and it just caught on, and so now people refer to this encounter as Cinny, and that's just a thing that happens.
Yep.
As far as the world goes, one of my favorite things I've taught my kids, and I hope it reverberates through generations or people they come in contact with, but is the importance of character and the idea of an acronym I came up with about finding hope, H-O-P-E. And when you find hope, you do so with a character of humility, optimism, patience, and empathy. Hmm. And to really install those things is kind of where I see the importance of human nature. Like we talked about earlier, fighting the instincts towards anger and violence and those kind of things to understand.
I thought you were going
to
say,
you know, our place.
Your greatest contribution was teaching your sons to be manly men who don't have fear.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. No, not that. I don't even know how to do that myself. but I also think it's valuable to say, as you guys talk about TPAC, very important, those kind of things. The work you've done with CinemaSins is incredibly important to the greater world. The amount of times we get emails or comments about a smile or joy or a laugh that the content brings to somebody who's going through the worst of times, having the worst of situations, and talking about how watching this video or that video helped pull them through, got them through, led them through to a better place, help them survive. I think it's important not to undersell the value of the work you guys have created.
And you.
I appreciate that, and it's my privilege to be a part of it. Honestly, it really is. And it's, you know, those emails will never stop being mind blowing.
Yeah.
You know, the content we create actually brings somebody through a rough time. Yeah. Yeah, that's a big deal. Yeah. I think that's a big deal.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then, that got somewhat deep, a little bit deep there.
A little deep.
All right. That's going to do it for this week. Chat, once again, thank you so much for coming out. We appreciate you so much for coming out and giving some really good opinions too during this movie. And I wish I could address them all, because that would be a great larger discussion at some point, talking about all the inaccuracies and the potential racist things about Apocalypto, but other things too. But thank you guys for coming out anyway and giving that discussion today. Also, next week is going to be Broadcast News, and that's going to do it for this week. We'll see you next time. See ya.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, guys. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
I was just reading a document somebody on Reddit put together of all the restaurants that Top Chef contestants have opened since appearing on the show, and an alarming number of them have closed.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like 90-some percent have closed. It's wild. The restaurant business is... I don't know why anyone goes into that business.
Yeah, don't we think that most restaurants close rather than stay open for... How long would you consider success? 5-10 years?
I don't know. Some of these restaurants, to recoup their costs, they probably have to stay open 5-10 years. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's before you're even really making a profit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't get it. Oh, well.
Is there just such an exorbitant, like, high side that it's worth it? Like, that the risk-reward is worth it? Or is the reward just... I get to make a halfway decent living, like, you know, like doing what I love.
So what I think happens, and I'm purely speculating, I think most restaurants like this are funded by private equity people or people who own the land. And they probably pay the celebrity chef like an upfront fee, so they get paid. And the only people who really struggle are everyone who works for the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And then the restaurant closes, and the landlord still owns the land, and the chef still got his upfront fee and moves on to another thing. I think. Because what's happening in Nashville on Broadway and 2nd Avenue is, in the last 5-10 years, this explosion of celebrity-themed bars, right? Kid Rock's bar, Justin Timberlake's bar, Jelly Roll has a bar opening. And I think those people are just a face and a name, and they show up every now and then, but they're paid up front for that. And then the people who own the land are the ones really making all the money. That's just, I'm just guessing.
Yeah.
Do you think some Midwesterners vacationing in Nashville see a Jelly Roll bar and think, oh, that sounds tasty, let's go in there?
Yeah, I do. Probably do. I still struggle with the fact that Jelly Roll is regularly, like, people say that and they're not referring to a tasty treat. Referring to.
That's the other thing, too, is the number of shows out there where, you know, it's either Gordon Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares or the... there's the other dude who does that, who's famous for it. He does Bar Rescue, I think, Bar is what Rescue, it's called. Yeah. You know, all of those, nearly all of those just don't sustain after they've been fixed, so quote unquote. And I always, I know these are entertaining to watch because of certain aspects to them, and, you know, especially the beginning when they're like pulling out drawers and there's mice running around, and you know, and they pull out the chicken that's like not, you know, that's been expired for 6 months and all that other type of stuff. But like, it's amazing, like, how anybody might believe that these restaurants or bars may stay open afterwards, because the people right. involved running them are just, they're not material. They're not business material at all. And, no. and it's like, there'll be a moment where Gordon or the other guy will take the owner aside and they'll say, you know what? You really suck at this and you need to stop doing it. And they like, well, I don't think I suck, and I think I should keep doing it. And they're like, okay. And then like the next scene, they're like, it's almost like the producers come to them and say, look, you don't have to change anything about what you're doing. This is just for the show. Pretend like you're getting along with the program, because there's no way these people are there and their mindset are getting are changing for any reason. I don't understand it. But then the whole makeover happens, and like, look, we did all this stuff to your bar. That's awesome now. And then, like, you know, it's almost always like afterwards they lasted 3 months after this, because these people aren't made to make these things.
It's not unlike the Extreme Home Makeover, where a lot of those recipients struggled in the wake of the show. Both because of, I've read a lot of horror stories about like shoddy craftsmanship behind the scenes, but also that they make the house so big that your utilities go up so much that you can't afford to live in your house anymore.
Well, and your property taxes go up so much too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, yeah, I don't think TV does any good for the people, the real people it features.
Already. No.
it's just a, it's just, it's a virus. It's coming in and it's taking what it wants and it's leaving you.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, there's a Biggest Loser docuseries, 3-episode docuseries that just dropped on Netflix. And I will say there's, you know, the Biggest Loser thing has been well known to have been just kind of a quick weight loss scam. Mm. You know, that most of these people have gained their weight back and, you know, those kind of things. So it's worth exploring, except it's already been explored. I didn't learn a single thing new in this documentary, and the documentary has no point of view. Mm. Like, it's just, it was just a waste of, you know, and it's 3 30-minute episodes.
Why not just make it?
You know what else you could have done?
Yeah.
What, you know what else you could have done with 3 30-minute episodes?
A movie.
Make a cohesive 90-minute feature-length documentary.
The thing,
I don't
though.
Know.
I was just thinking about this the other day, like the amount of time that is in this documentary series could have been a documentary. And I think the point is that most people look at something as an hour and a half as a commitment. They look at 30-minute episodes. They'll watch those all in a row, not as a commitment.
Yeah. I'm sure there's something to that. It's frustrating to my wife loves documentaries, and we've gotten to a point now where it's hard to even speak the right language. Like, how many episodes is this one? Oh, this is a movie. Oh, I thought this one had multiple episodes. No, that was the other one that was about the same topic, and that was a series. And this, there's so many freaking docuseries. There's what's that one? Never mind. It doesn't matter.
I really enjoyed the Paul Reubens one. I haven't watched the Billy Joel one. I think there's a Billy Joel
there
one.
There is.
That's out.
I feel like I'm. Don't care enough about Billy Joel's music to get much out of that.
Yeah, that's possible.
I certainly respect him in the landscape of American music and his accomplishments and talent. I just have never been like the biggest. I've never owned a Billy Joel album.
Yeah, I guess the docu series goes into, you know, his early career and how he basically stole his best friend's wife and like it's just
cool.
But he's there giving interviews about this stuff. It's really interesting to me how people are becoming more open about just talking about the terrible things in their past and those kind of things. There's a great WWE documentary that came out recently too that had a bunch of Vince McMahon stuff. But the big stuff on him dropped while they were filming the documentary. Oh, so it's a really kind of interesting. They were at the right place at the right time, you know.
Have they gotten rid of him yet? So, or is he still involved?
Yes. No, I think he is out, gone. If I don't really follow World Wrestling Entertainment, but yeah, I think he is gone.
And at some point, we're also going to get some mass. I have a feeling we're going to get some massive Denzel Washington interview where he's just going to just go off on everything. You can see the sort of the
seems that way.
Ticking time bomb. Like I keep seeing all these little clips that come up, and I'm like, oh my God, here's a guy who no longer gives a fuck, and he is just. You know, and he hasn't said anything like personal about anybody else or anything like that. But I'm waiting for that interview where somebody just, I don't know, irks him just enough that he starts talking about people. And
there's nothing better than the aging Hollywood star who's quit giving a fuck and just starts speaking bluntly. Mm-hmm. Like that Sharon Stone book.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think Denzel's one of those guys. He's certainly going to have stories if he decides to tell them, because he's been in that business for 60 years, 40 years.
Yeah. The one that I saw over the weekend was an SI video where he said something like, all we are doing out here is sitting around, you know, like people just sitting around who never done anything in their life, like pretending like they know or whatever. And then he says something about something about throwing hands or something. And he's like, you go out and throw hands or whatever. And he's like, oh, and I know how to throw hands too. I'm not just joking when I can go out and I can throw hands if I have to and blah, blah, blah. I'm not even giving that video its due. It's so like intense watching him talk about this stuff. And there's like another one where he's on a red carpet or something. And there's somebody who's asking him a question and he keeps saying, just stop, just stop, just stop. keeps saying that.
Boy, I never want Denzel saying that to me.
Hell no.
I interrupted Denzel Washington at his table. In the Critics' Choice Awards one year, he was sitting there, and it is common practice during commercials to go around and find celebrities you like and tell them how much you love their stuff and, you know, just kind of have that moment. And this was maybe like my third year, so I still hadn't kind of perfected what is and isn't, you know, okay or cool or whatever. And I went up and I just said, you know, I said Denzel or whatever. And he turned and looked at me and just stared at me. And I kind of offered my hand, and he grabbed my hand, shook my hand, and he turned. And as he's shaking my hand, he turns and starts talking to the rest of the table. Like he was clear. It was clear. Fine, I'll shake your hand, but
go away. Yeah.
I was like, I get it. Totally. That's on me. Yeah. I'm interrupting.
I found that experience very terrifying, as you remember. I did not go to talk to anybody except the people who were at our table. And like, I just didn't know how to do all that. I've talked to celebrities before, but there's been different circumstances. And like in this one, it's like, how do I have any right to approach a table and start talking to you? And then there was a point where Bill Pullman's just standing like right next to me, like right next. And I'm like sitting there going, oh my God, I want to talk about Zero Effect so much, but